Good morning to all.
Good morning.
We have quite an increase in attendance this morning compared to our icy Sunday last week. We welcome back Clint McCann for his second of three appearances for the series on the Psalms for Lent. Today is the first Sunday in Lent, and we will be studying Psalm 25, which is appointed for the first Sunday, right, and Psalm 22, which is appointed for next week for the second Sunday. So that brings us to Clint. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Alan. Appreciate it. And thanks for the opportunity and welcome this morning. It is a nice and sunny out today, so I'm glad to see that. Alan has sort of set the agenda here. We will talk about 25 and 22. We're going to start with 25 since that's the song for today, and we'll see how maybe that'll take the whole time. Probably not, but anyway. And then Psalm 22 is the second Sunday. That also Psalm 22, it will sound familiar, and will also show up in Holy Week for Good Friday. And then the remaining Psalms in Lent are 19, 107, and 31. So that's probably more than we can talk about in detail next week, but we'll get a good start on those. I've listed some of the Lenten virtues, I'm calling them, that we put up on the board last week out of Psalm 51, gratitude, the correlate of grace, being forgiven, the appropriate response is gratitude, and things that seem to go with gratitude, generosity and humility. We'll see if we can add to the list of Lenten virtues today as we encounter Psalms 25 in particular and 22. Greetings from Eden Seminary again. As I said last week, we are happy to have connections between Eden Seminary and this congregation and Lutherans in the Metro St. Louis area. We will continue to look forward to that kind of partnership and cooperation. So thank you for that. It so happens that Psalm 25, two of my favorite liturgical composers have versions of Psalm 25. So I'm going to suggest we start with that in a way to experience the Psalms before we actually think and talk about them. This first, I dropped my player as I was getting in the car, so I tested it a while ago, and I think it works. So if it works, this first version of Psalm 25, and it focuses at the beginning on that first phrase, if you have Bibles. This is by Marty Hagen. From a collection entitled Psalms for the Church Year.
Verse 8.
good old 10, 11, 12. I was pointing out some of the verses. I obviously didn't do the whole psalm, but one of the advantages of singing a psalm like this or composing a kind of responsorial psalm is you can pick a verse for the refrain that gives it a kind of prominence because it recurs at several points, plus it can be sung by the congregation, not just a choir or a cantor at that point. And that's the way it's designed. In this case, his refrain was the first verse. You notice it came back again and again. To you, O Lord, I lift my soul. We'll talk about that in a minute. The other version, which also features that opening line, is by Richard Brooksfort Colligan. Richard is advertises himself as a contemporary psalmist. He's Lutheran in background. I'm not sure which Lutheran, but he's Lutheran in background. He's ELCA now. That's the first cut. This is the one here. As I was saying before the thing blasted out, Richard advertises himself as a contemporary psalmist. He felt a call, he says, 10 years ago or so, to pay attention as a musician to the Psalms, which makes sense since the Psalms were originally musically sung and played and so on. So he's now has a psalm song, he calls them, for almost the whole Psalter. I think he's right at 140, and there are 150. So after 10 years, he's made his way through just about the whole thing. This is from a collection called Shout for Joy that was originally published by Lutherans. Augsburg Fortress Press published two of his collections in a thing called the Psalm Project. Then they ran out of money, which is not unusual for the religious publishing houses these days. They're all short on money. So they quit funding Richard as a contemporary psalmist. So he's an independent musician now and manages to make a living doing that. I'm not quite sure how. But he does. He has a website called Psalm Immersion, all one word, .com. And one called worldmaking.net, worldmaking, all one word, .net, in case you want to pursue some of his stuff. And you can subscribe to him. I hadn't quite figured out how to do that. But anyway, he comes to Eden Seminary every fall as our artist in residence and helps me in my Psalms class for a three-hour session and takes the lead in organizing, and he's the lead performer in what is called the Eden Festival of Psalms. So we've had six of those already. And the 7th Eden Festival of Psalms is scheduled for Sunday evening, October the 7th, 2018, if you want to get that on your calendar. Last year we held the Psalm Festival the same afternoon, evening as the Crop Walk, late afternoon. Yeah. Some of you have participated in the Crop Walk and supported the Crop Walk, which we appreciate, or I appreciate. So at any rate, that juxtaposition had the effect of really adding attendance to the Psalm Festival. So we had like 175 people last year, more than double than we'd ever had. And it was really good because Richard is there, Paul Vasile, who is our Eden musician and just a world renowned composer, music leader, and so on. So anyway, it's really, really good. And you're all invited. I'll try to remind Alan or somebody so he can announce it as time gets closer. But let's talk about, you'll notice that both of these versions, I think rightfully so, featured the opening line in a kind of refrain. To you, O Lord, and this is the traditional translation. I've got the NRSV, so we'll see. I think there may be some different translations. We'll see. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. Is that what everybody says? Any different than that? See, I think that's a really bad translation. I'm going to tell you why in a minute. Approaching that, let me say one more thing as a kind of way of background. One of the things that has characterized the study of the Book of Psalms in the last 30 years or so, I mean a little bit more than that, 30 to 35 years, the last couple of scholarly generations, let's say, which my career has spanned, and I'm close to retirement now, or at least retirement age. I am retirement age, if it's 65. So the last 35 years or so, Psalm scholarship has been characterized in large part by paying attention to something that was not paid attention to for years and years, that is the shape of the Psalter itself. That is, what significance is it the way the Psalms are arranged in the Book of Psalms? Or is there any significance to that? Some people still say no, it's just a random collection that they threw together. There's no particular organizing principle or logic to it. It's just a bunch of prayers and songs that they put together, and then we have it. Now, but many scholars have suggested otherwise. So we're at a place in the Psalter. We're at 25 here. 22 is in view. 19 is coming up next week. So I just wanted to share this with you as a kind of update on Psalm scholarship. I think it's important for understanding 25. But at any rate, a number of scholars have noticed a pattern when it comes to Psalms 15 to 24. Now 25 is the next one, so that's why we're in the neighborhood here. In particular, they've noticed what they call a chiastic pattern. That is, Psalm 15 and 24 correspond as the boundaries of this pattern. They're both the same type. They're entrance liturgies. They both ask the question, who shall ascend your holy hill, and so on. They seem to have been used as a kind of ritual for people approaching the temple gates or something like that. Psalm 16 and 23 are both psalms of assurance. Psalm 17 and 22 are both psalms of lament. Psalms 18 and 20, 21 are both royal psalms, psalms that mention the king explicitly. And then the effect of that kind of chiastic pattern is to emphasize the boundaries and the center of the chiasm. As it moves toward a center, and then moves back out to where it started, there's a particular focus on the middle. And Psalm 19, as we'll see next week, mentions the word Torah, usually translated law, but better instruction. Yeah, Alan?
Could you just say briefly what chiastic means?
Yeah, chiasm, chiastic or chiasm is a Greek, it's off the Greek letter chi, to name this pattern. Well, if I'd written it differently, it would have been an X instead of at least straight lines. So that's where it's from. And it's a fairly typical pattern in Hebrew poetry and narrative to move toward the middle with corresponding elements. I was chair of the Society of Biblical Literature Psalms group or section several years ago. And somebody's, people sent me books because they thought I could help publicize them, which I couldn't. But anyway, a whole book was just a collection of chiastic patterns that somebody somewhere had found in the Old Testament. So it's a fairly frequent pattern. Now, what interests me about this in regard to Psalm 25 is you've got an entrance sort of thing focusing Torah, but at some point in Jewish, Hebrew, Israelite, Judean, Jewish history, there came a point, the exile in particular, where people couldn't get to the temple very easily. There wasn't a temple for a while after the Babylonians destroyed it in 587. And even when they rebuilt it, there were Jews who couldn't get there. Why? Some were in Babylon. Some had fled to Egypt. We read the end of the book of Jeremiah, they hauled him off to Egypt, sort of against his will. In other words, at the Babylonian exile was the beginning of the diaspora, it's called, or the dispersion. So now they're Jews not in close proximity to the Jerusalem temple where they were supposed to go worship. Well, what do you do? Well, it's possible, and there's a friend of mine who teaches at Pittsburgh Seminary has said, in the diaspora era from 587 on, what happened was a movement within Judaism whereby the Torah itself became this is Jerome Creech, who teaches at Pittsburgh Seminary, the Torah became a surrogate for the temple. In other words, if you couldn't actually go to the temple to bring your gifts or sacrifices or so on, you studied Torah. That is, you put yourself in touch with God by way of God's word. And that could be accessible anywhere, particularly by this late time where they had written it down so that the Torah, the five books of Moses, were probably had taken written form by this time or soon thereafter and so on. Now, so at any rate, you've got this pattern here, and then you come to Psalm 25, and what's the first thing that we hear in Psalm 25? You would expect maybe some psalm about the temple or something, but it's not. To you, O Lord, I lift my soul. Part of the reason I think it's a bad translation is I don't think that Hebrew word means soul. It's a word in Hebrew, some of you may have seen it, nephesh. It means life. Originally, it was neck. Now, I know of one place that right off the top of my head where the psalm, major translations of the psalm, translate nephesh as neck. It's if you want to flip around in your Bible with me, it's the beginning of Psalm 69, which is a lament psalm, the opening line of which, save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my nephesh, to my neck, you see. And I think what happened, although I'm not absolutely sure about this, think about this portion of one's anatomy, the neck or the throat. Everything necessary to sustain life goes through here. Food, passageways, esophagus, food, water, and air. You see, so I think the word that originally meant neck or throat came to mean something like life or vitality. Sometimes the NRSV translates it simply as self, and sometimes as life. So that's how I want to translate that. The Common English Bible the new translation that I had a hand in making, help making the Psalms translation, we went with, and it's a little bit awkward, it doesn't have the same ring to it, "To you, O Lord, I lift my whole being." So usually when nephesh occurred, we translate it as whole being, self, you see. Now, that's part of the issue here. The other part is, and this relates to a temple word, I think. The word that they're translating, lift up, is used elsewhere in the Old Testament to bring your sacrifice and lift it or have it lifted up to the altar, you see. So I think, given this focus on entering the temple and then Torah, there's something to my friend's suggestion that Torah has become a kind of surrogate for the temple. If you can't go and bring your sacrifice, what do you do instead? You offer, nasa is the Hebrew word if you know Hebrew. It means to lift up, but in this sense to offer. It's used for, you offer yourself. You see, your whole self. We kind of saw that in Psalm 51, didn't we? A little bit, the critique of sacrifice, or at least the modification of the sacrificial system. The end of Psalm 51, remember? Question in verses 16 and 17, "For you have no delight in sacrifice." In other words, you don't have to go to the temple and take your sacrifices. That's not what pleases God anyway. If I were to give a burnt offering, you would not be pleased. The sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. So you give yourself, you give your heart. And in Hebrew, heart is really the sort of seat of both emotion and volition or will. I think a similar move here. "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul," or as I would prefer to translate it, "To you, O Lord, I offer my life." You see, I offer my life. I give myself over to you. A kind of yielding, surrender, and so on. Now, not surprisingly, I think, if Torah, God's instruction or teaching, you know, the NRSV and the other major translations usually translate Torah as law, as in Psalm 1. You know, the happy person is the one who delights in the law, it says. Well, again, it's a bad translation. Law, Torah means teaching or instruction or will. You see, so it's not surprising to me, the psalmist says, "I offer my life to you," that he or she is open, particularly, I think this is the emphasis in Psalm 25, is open to God's teaching or God's instruction. Can you see some instances here where the vocabulary of, I call it pedagogical vocabulary, vocabulary of teaching and learning occurs? Verse 9, he leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. What else? So we've got, let's see, we'll list some verses, teaching, learning. There's actually several Hebrew roots involved here. Verse 9, what other verses?
5, 4, 8, 12.
That may cover it, but that's enough to make the point in any case. The psalmist is clearly open to God's teaching. "Make me know your ways." That's one of the Hebrew roots involved. That's actually the word to know in a particular verb form that has a causative sense. So it's, and the translators have captured that here, "cause me" or "make me to know" in verse 4. "Lead me, teach me" in verse 5. What else did we say? Verse 8, "therefore instructs sinners in the way." What did we have, 9 up there? Leads, teaches again. Well, yeah, verse 9, teaches. Now, the word two times, the one that's in translated instructor and teach is actually the Hebrew verb. There are three verbs represented here, but one of them is the Hebrew verb, the noun of which would be Torah. So you, with Hebrew, you've got three-letter roots, and then you can conjugate those three-letter roots by adding stuff to the beginning and the end to make a different verb, persons, and so on. But you can also add stuff and transpose the three-letter root into a noun. So you've got the verb on which the noun tor is based twice here. And we talked about repetition last time. So there's plenty of it here. So how would a Lenten virtue might be, how might we want to add to our list on what we've seen in Psalm 25 so far? I'm going to put it this way. Openness to God's teaching. The word or the root for Torah is, I think, obviously important in Judaism. The first five books of Moses are known as what? The Torah, that is the teaching. A lot of that there are laws involved, commandments, like the Ten Commandments, of course, that occur twice, and other legal codes and so on. So, really, Torah is broader than law. There's a Jewish scholar who teaches at Harvard Divinity School, very famous, prominent Hebrew Bible, Old Testament scholar, John Levinson, who has an article on Torah, and he says Torah can mean something like written commandments or laws, but it can also mean traditions about biblical material, the rabbinic commentaries and the Mishnah, the Talmud in Judaism, traditions of the elders is what the New Testament calls it. But he also says Torah, even within Judaism, can mean something as broad as unmediated divine instruction. I mean, that's pretty broad. Unmediated, what would we Christians maybe call that? Revelation, yes, openness to ongoing revelation. Or maybe even in some circles, openness to the Holy Spirit. But in any case, an orientation to God and the world where you are open to God's teaching or God's will. That may mean studying Scripture, the text itself and commentary or writings about the text, essays and articles and commentary. But it may mean to do, and the UCC is famous for this, it may mean to do what? Just listen. Analyze. Think. You know, what's the UCC phrase that would captures this, I think? God is still speaking. Yeah, God is still speaking. That is, revelation continues. It can't be restricted simply to the ancient text or to commentary about the text. You see, our own reason and experience fit in with the appropriate. So openness to God's teaching or will is part of, it seems to me, has to be a major part of what it means to offer one's self to God. That is, to orient one's life and existence around Torah. In other words, around God's teaching or agenda. Now, actually, that takes you right back to the beginning of the Psalter, I think. I mentioned Psalm 1 a moment ago, and I think Psalm 25 is in continuity with it. The first two verses of Psalm 1 mention the word Torah. Happy are those who don't follow the advice of the wicked or take the path of sinners, tread us into the seat of scoffers, but their delight is in the Torah, the teaching of the Lord, and on God's teaching they meditate day and night. That is, according to the beginning of the Psalter, true happiness or fulfillment begins with orienting one's life, mind, heart, whatever, day and night, constantly, to God, rather than simply to the self, to God and to God's teaching or God's will. So that may be something we want to add to the list. Anything else out of Psalm 25? I think there may be other things that we might prompt us to add to the list. Other virtues that stand out, or stances, or what's immediate? Oh Lord, to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul, I offer my life. What's the very next word? Oh my God, in you I trust. That might be another. And of course, there's a kind of countercultural edge to this when we think about what are we oriented to in our culture day and night, lots of times. What?
I just said fake news.
Fake news? Yeah, yeah. Or media. Yeah, we're I mean, think. I was reading for my prophets class this past week, rereading Jim Wallace's book, yeah. Mm-hmm. The Uncommon Good. He is pointing out how we've just virtually ignored the well-being of the whole in our pursuit of individual fulfillment or satisfaction or what we think is happiness. And there, he pointed, one of his statistics, and I've seen it other places too, is that the typical average North American U.S. citizen spends 8 hours a day somehow interacting with screens. It could be TV, the people next door to us at night, in the middle of the night, when I get up, I can hear their TV. It runs 24 hours. You see, now it may be because they're, you know, don't get out, aren't too mobile. It may be people need to watch TV day and night. I don't know. But and of course, a lot of it's not TV. It's, for younger people especially, computer screens and iPads and phones and so on. Yeah, 8 hours a day. Now, I'm not sure that's good. Wallace didn't think that was particularly helpful. But that orients us in a particular direction. And much of what we see and hear doesn't encourage us to be open to God's teaching or will. You see, it's not about that at all. It's about self-fulfillment. And,
when did Wallace write that book?
Oh, this, it's been out several years. Yeah, maybe, what? Does anybody know Jim Wallace, the date of Wallace's The Uncommon Good? He's written a couple since then, one on racism. Maybe 10 years ago, 8 to 10 years ago. It's still very current, however, in terms of the failure, our failure to pursue the common good, as I understand. But at any rate, trust, faith, you might be, if you combine these, you might want to say obedience somehow. And again, the countercultural edge, our everything around us, tends to orient us to the self and what we want rather than the other and what God may have in mind for us as individuals and or collectives. What else? Other things that stand out here in Psalm 25?
Well, this may fit with humility, that need to be forgiven.
Yes, there is. You can see why Psalm 25 fits with Lent and the theme of forgiveness. I think that, in a sense, that does go with humility, but it also is. Which verses in particular there? 7, maybe. Do not remember the sins of my youth or my transgressions. Those are words that we saw in Psalm 51, both of the word for sin, the general missing the mark, intentionally or unintentionally, whereas the word they translate transgression is willful rebellion. That is, we disobey on purpose. Do not remember the sins of my youth or my transgressions according to your steadfast love. Remember me. So verse 7. Now, Psalm 25, interestingly, although it has this clear confessional dimension, is not one of the church's 7 penitential psalms. 51 is. I don't think any of the rest of these for Lent are among the church's penitential psalms. 25 could be, it seems to me, given the themes that we've identified. The need to be forgiven in verse 7. Where else?
18.
Yeah.
11.
Yeah. 11, for your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt. Again, that's one of the words we saw in Psalm 51 that was translated guilt. Some of the time, iniquity, part of the time. Pardon my guilt, for it is great. Where else was it? 18, yeah. Consider my affliction and my trouble and forgive all my sins. So that's clearly in the penitential trajectory there. The need for and the request to be forgiven. Good. What else? Anything else that you notice? Yeah, Alan.
I don't know if you can make a virtue out of this, but at least 3 times there's mention of steadfast love, mm-hmm. which we saw in last week's Psalm 2.
Yes.
So at least an awareness of God's steadfast love. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's important. I'm going to use the Hebrew term here. Hesed, God's steadfast love. You know, it's such a rich word, hesed, that it's difficult to translate. The usual translation is what Alan was using. It's what the NRSV uses generally, steadfast love. It could also, the NIV tends to go with unfailing love. The CEB that I mentioned a while ago goes with faithful love most of the time. Other translations that have been suggested, I think the King James is loving kindness. Other translations are covenant love or loyalty. It's such a rich word in terms of its range of meaning that one of the most recent commentaries on the Psalms, it's in the New International Commentary on the Old Testament that was three authors that combined to divide up the Psalter and comment on it since it's so long. But their decision was, when this word showed up in the Psalms, not to translate it even, but to transliterate it. So that in their translations, they provide a translation of their own for each psalm. When this shows up, they just put the transliteration hesed rather than attempting to translate. And then, of course, they, in their introduction, tell why they've done that and their sort of strategy. But yeah, awareness of God's steadfast love. In other places, and the NRSV translates it saints, usually when it occurs, that root is used to designate people who demonstrate these virtues, that is, who trust or faith. And better than saints probably would be, and this would be an awkward translation, the steadfastly loved ones or the steadfastly loving ones. That is, those who, shaped by God's character, which is fundamentally hesed. Remember Exodus 34:6, the divine self-revelation of Moses, the Lord, gracious, merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in hesed, showing hesed to the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, and so on. So that an identity of the faithful who know they need to be forgiven, who have been, asked for forgiveness, are therefore grateful, we might call ourselves the steadfastly loved or loving ones, and maybe both. So yeah, good. What else? Anything else you notice? Not necessarily to add to the list of virtues, but it could be that.
How
about patience?
What's that? Patience.
Patience. Mhm. Yeah, and in that regard, any particular verse?
5.
Yeah. There's one word that might get at it.
21, wait.
Yeah, the word wait. Mhm. We've talked about repetition, its importance. I think the word they're translating wait occurs 3 times. Look at verse 3. I think, is that what you said? Do not let those who wait for you be put to shame. Verse 5, for you I wait all day long. And then toward the end of the psalm, and again, patterns of repetition are important. Oftentimes what's important, they'll put it at or near the beginning, like in verses 3 and 5, and they'll come back to it in the end, as seems to be the case here, because when you get near the end of the psalm, there's the same phrase again. May integrity and uprightness, those might be virtues too, we could add integrity and uprightness, preserve me, for I wait for you. Element of patience. What else? There's another translation of that particular Hebrew root, and the NRSV translators, interestingly, kind of go back and forth. Sometimes they'll translate this particular Hebrew root wait. At other points, for no apparent reason, they'll translate it hope. I hope, my hope is in you. That I think, maybe, you know, there's a lot of attention in recent constructive, systematic theological thinking. Jürgen Moltmann's A Theology of Hope. The necessity, well, not real recent, but the necessity of living amidst brokenness and chaos, not giving up, but rather fundamentally living with hope as a way to energize and motivate ourselves in these directions, to continue to be open to God and oriented to God's teaching and will in the midst of a culture and a society and a world that seems to have very little interest in that. The danger in that is to give up or give in You see, if you can't beat them, join them. You see, how do we maintain, and this is a word that's showing up in our culture for a variety of reasons, all good. How do we resist cultural pressures and drifts or directions? What's going to energize us to stay grateful and faithful and humble and generous amidst a society that encourages us to be self-serving and acquire more and more and more? I think part of the answer to that question, what will sustain and energize us, is a sense of patient waiting or hope. You see. Good. Other possibilities here? Or things you notice? I'm going to add integrity. I like integrity too. The word they're translating integrity here, and that's a good translation, literally means wholeness. The word means, how do we maintain a sense of coherency or wholeness about ourselves so that we present ourselves as these things? Integrity was one of the virtues that was identified by the narrator at the beginning of the book of Job, you remember? Feared God, faithful and upright, feared God and turned away from evil. Integrity is one of the themes in the book of Job. Job maintained his integrity against the accusations of his friends and so on. So integrity, anything else?
There's something about relationship. It talks about friendship. This is the way it's always been.
The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear Him. Fear is probably not a good translation. There's one German Old Testament scholar, Klaus Festemann, who several years ago said probably the best translation of what is the word that's usually translated fear is actually faith, you see. So faith, again, the friendship of the Lord is for those who fear or trust or have faith. And God makes covenant known to them. Covenant is, that's all about... relationship. So to know and claim that relationship. Now, some of these psalms, like this one, could sound kind of exclusive. Is the friendship of the Lord just for those who have faith? That sounds like a restriction on it. My way to deal with those, and Psalm, I've been working on Psalm 103 for something else about the fear of the Lord, shows up there. And the suggestion is that's only for those who the forgiveness is only for those who fear. I think it's not that God's willingness to forgive is constrained or restricted. I think the implication here is that God's willingness to forgive won't have any beneficial effect unless we're open to receive it. That for me is faith or trust. So the restriction is not that God is limiting God's will to forgive, but that effectively it will do no good if we're not open to receive acceptance or forgiveness. One other thing I want to highlight, and it's frequent in all of the lament psalms, usually Psalm 25, although I tend to think of it as a Torah psalm because of all this kind of stuff, but usually in the commentaries it's going to be translated, categorized as a lament, a complaint. And part of the reason for that is, and this is typical of the plant, is the enemies. Notice the enemies in verse 2. Do not let me put to shame. Do not let my enemies exult over me. And then toward the end, verse 19, consider how many are my foes and with what violent hatred they hate me. This is part of the reason people don't like the laments, is you've got the enemies are always there. I refer to it like Psalm 23, not just the presence of the enemies, but I call it the omnipresence of the enemies, because in these psalms they're always there. All of this sort of stuff, as important as it is, the presence of the enemies or the omnipresence of the enemies reminds us that there are people, forces, things out there that we will have to display or exhibit or claim these virtues in the midst of opposition. Opposition from certain people, cultural forces, whatever. You see, the enemies always seem to be there. Now, there's been books and books written on in Old Testament studies about the identity of the enemies. Who are they? What were they doing? I don't think there's any real consensus as to exactly who these enemies might have been. Sometimes the psalmist names members of his own community or her own community as enemies. That may well be. Some people seem to think the enemies are national enemies of Israel or Judah. We don't know. It's prompted several scholars recently to suggest that given the ambiguity or at least the uncertainty surrounding the identity of the enemies, we might profitably think about the enemies as anyone or anything in our context or environment or world that opposes God and God's teaching or instruction, you see. In my Psalms course this past semester, we looked at all kinds of Psalms. It was interesting that a number of students chose to focus on the laments, not as just ways to express our individual troubles, but they were claiming the laments as a form of social protest or resistance in conversation with, for instance, in our community with the Black Lives Matter sort of movement. You see, that the protest, really, the protest element of these, or the resistance element against the enemies might be particularly important when we think corporately about the possibilities that these laments invite protest of injustice, for instance, so that they're not just means of expressing our individual troubles and suffering, although that's predominantly how they've been used. They may be ways to articulate what is not right with the world or what is not right with our communities. And if so, they may have a kind of really significant dimension in our time and place. But anyway, I wanted you to notice the enemy language there, the presence of the enemies. Anything else? We don't have a whole lot of time left for Psalm 22, but I do want to say a little bit about it. Anything else on 25?
If we don't know who the enemies are here, then we don't know the time either.
We don't. No, I think dating the Psalms is notoriously difficult. Yeah, I wrote a whole commentary without venturing to date a single Psalm, except in very rough terms. It sounds like it could be a response to the exile. Psalm 137 that has them by the waters of Babylon, for instance, seems like a exilic setting, or post-exilic setting at least. But yeah, we don't know the times, I don't think. Which is frustrating for scholars who want to try to pin everything down. On the other hand, the uncertainty is an invitation for us to insert ourselves, perhaps, in the Psalms. We don't know exactly who the psalmist's enemies might have been or what they were doing, but we can identify in our time and place forces, let's say, trends, people sometimes, who seem to have nothing in common with these virtues and, in fact, represent quite the opposite of humility and generosity and gratitude and trust and awareness of the importance of God's love and showing integrity. I mean, I can think of lots of people. I won't name any. But you see what I mean, I think. Now, Psalm 22 the enemies might be a good transition to Psalm 22 because what is happening to the psalmist here, which leads him or her to say in the beginning how at least it feels, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, part of the reason that Psalm 22 is so famous is not just because it's a long and intense lament. It is that, one of the most lengthy and intense in the Psalter. But those opening lines become what in the New Testament? Jesus' own prayer from the cross, according to the Gospels of Matthew and Mark. So my God, why have you forsaken me? Becomes Jesus' lament or prayer from the cross. Part of the problem, it feels like God forsakenness, but there's a human element to what is happening to the psalmist. And again, you cannot read Psalm 22 without being reminded of the passion narratives in the Gospels. Historical critics, New Testament historical critics, suggest that in all likelihood the Gospel writers didn't actually know all the details of Jesus' suffering and passion, so they're reading it in conversation with Psalm 22 and supplying details, perhaps. Or, I mean, if that's a little troubling to you, just say what certainly would have been the case. Jesus would have known Psalm 22 and may well have taken it as a kind of model for faithfulness in the midst of opposition, which Jesus certainly knew from the very beginning of his ministry and coming to a culmination in his suffering and passion. So either way, or some of both maybe. But what's going on? Scorned by others, verse 6. Mocking, verse 7. And in the midst of that, it's not just forsakenness, it's a kind of remembrance of God's faithfulness, verse 9 and 10. It was you who took me from the womb, kept me safe on my mother's breast, and so on. And then the prayer, in the midst of what feels like God's forsakenness, do not be far from me, for trouble is near, and there is no one to help. The near and far become kind of a theme, actually. Why are you so far from helping me, verse 1, and then the prayer, do not be far from me, sort of that repetition signals the first a kind of round of lament. There are two rounds of lament, verses 1 to 11, marked by far and far in 1 and 11. And then there's a second round of lament from verses 12 to 21. And again, what do all the... what's the characteristic imagery in 12 to 21? Bulls, strong bulls, what else? Dogs,
lions.
Yeah, wild oxen. Walter Brueggemann, I heard him talking about some of the, my predecessor at Eden Seminary, probably the most famous biblical scholar in the country. I heard him talking about Psalm 22 at a presentation. He said, it sounds like the psalmist is in a zoo, you see. But of course, the language is not meant to be taken literally. It's metaphorical. Who are these animals? And we still use that to characterize people as animals sometimes, given their behavior. Yeah. Of the title of the song.
Yeah,
I wish we knew. We know what the language means, pretty much. But most people think that's the title of the melody or mode in which the song was sung.
Okay.
We're not sure about that.
No,
it wouldn't be connected. No, it wouldn't be connected to the leader. The deer would not be a threatening animal, in all likelihood. So elsewhere in the Psalms, you do hear about deer, like the beginning of Psalm 42, and the deer is not a problem there. The deer is almost a kind of model of longing for God. As a deer longs for flowing streams, so my soul, or self, nephesh, longs for you, O God. The opening line of Psalm 42. So, but I wouldn't really have any connection to the hostile animals later.
Right, right.
Well, that's a good question. We don't know. It could be. I kind of like the idea that it's a deliberate contrast. I'll sing this song about a nice animal in contrast to all those ones that are after me. Yeah. So at any rate, the animal imagery and the other thing that characterizes the second round of lament is the bodily imagery, the anatomical stuff. Mouths, and I'm poured out, bones are broken, heart is like wax, melted within my breast, my mouth is dried up, my tongue sticks to my jaw, and so on. My hands and feet have shriveled. So they're carrying the theme of the lament here, just pervasive opposition, hostile opposition that leads to debilitating effects. Now, that's clear, but what happens in the middle of the psalm, toward the middle, verse 21, maybe in the middle of verse 21, where there's still an animal involved, but the tone changes dramatically from a heartfelt lament, complaint, forsakenness, to what in verse 21 and 22? From the horns of the wild oxen, In other words, from the hostile animal. You have, NRSV says, rescued me. The Hebrew says, answered me, somehow. I think that's the better reading, particularly since it counters the, or turns around the verse 2 stuff, but you do not answer. Well, an answer now has come, and whatever the form of the answer or the content of the answer, the situation has changed dramatically. So instead of complaining now and asking for urgent asking for help, it's what?
Praise.
That's right. I will tell of your name to my brothers and sisters, you who fear the Lord, trusting God. Praise God, for God did not despise or abhor the affliction of the afflicted. God did not hide God's face from me, as the earlier complaint might have suggested. For you comes my praise in the great congregation. My vows I will pay before those who fear God. The poor shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek God shall praise the Lord. May your hearts live forever. And then in verse 29, at least there's the imagination that this sort of praise service here will include not just the psalmist and the poor, but even those who have died somehow. To him indeed, to God indeed, shall all who sleep in the earth bow down. Before God shall bow all who go down to the dust. Well, that's not typical Hebrew anthropology. In Hebrew anthropology, there was no afterlife except an undifferentiated realm of Sheol, the land of the dead, or the realm of the dead. And you went there. Everybody went there. It wasn't reward or punishment. It was just the realm of the dead. And even God had no access to it, nor did anyone in Sheol have access to God. That's the ordinary view that we infer or conclude elsewhere. But here, because it's different, Ellen Davis, who teaches at Duke University, has suggested that the psalmist here is exploding the limits. It is the normal limits of Hebrew anthropology. Affirming in a way that other texts don't, that somehow not even death itself will be able to separate the psalmist from God. She says she doesn't think it's a developed doctrine of resurrection that would come in later Judaism. It's evident in the book of Daniel, for instance, and of course in Christianity. But it's exploding the limits of the normal Hebrew anthropology by imagining at least an unbroken connection with God. Now, if that's the case, this psalm is exploding the limits, we can see perhaps how it might have been suitable not only to articulate Jesus' suffering and passion, but also perhaps to anticipate or articulate somehow the reality of resurrection, a kind of unbroken connection with God that not even death itself can break, you see. There may be also an anticipation not just of Jesus' suffering and death and resurrection. There may be hints of Jesus' ministry here, the way Jesus ate in particular. Look at verse 26. The poor shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek God shall praise the Lord. What did Jesus do in a life of humility, generosity, gratitude, openness to God and God's teaching, awareness of God's love, hoping in God? What did Jesus do? How did he? For the poor, who are often told that they, and still are often told, that they deserve it, and that their suffering is part of what they brought on themselves and punishment for their sin and so on, Jesus said what? Happy are the poor. Blessed are the poor. Not just the poor in spirit in the opening beatitude in Matthew, but blessed are the poor in Luke's version of the Beatitudes, you see. So that Jesus exhibited in his life and ministry a kind of gratitude, praise, humility, openness to God and God's teaching that correspond, I would say, to the affirmation of the psalmist here, the poor shall eat and be satisfied. What may be in the background here is a Thanksgiving meal, even, a gratitude meal, whereby you brought a sacrifice if you came to the temple, and one of the kinds of sacrifice was the Thanksgiving sacrifice, or the peace offering it's sometimes called. And not only did the person who brought the sacrifice eat, but he or she, probably he in those days, could invite others, neighbors, to participate. And this is a vision of a sacrifice, a sacrificial meal, a Thanksgiving meal, in which everybody participates. You see, even the poor and the needy. who are often excluded and are still often excluded. So anyway, I know our time is up. So we can come back to that, but primarily next week we're going to move on. We touched on Psalm 19. We'll go back to that. It's a Torah psalm, a kind of unique, really. 107 is a thanksgiving song, and Psalm 31 is a lament, but it's a lament with generous affirmations of trust and assurance, so it's a little bit different than the other lament. Thank you. And Alan, final words?
Just a comment about Psalm 22 for next week. The psalm portion that we'll sing next week actually doesn't start until this break, around verse 22 or 23.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
But it's good to have this background of this lament,
the,
and the horrid conditions that that the psalmist describes, and then what we'll be singing next week.
Good.
Okay, Clint has mentioned what we're studying next week. That is listed in the bulletin. Those psalms are listed at the bottom of the calendar page in today's bulletin.
Yeah.
So you'll have those references. We won't sing all of those verses of all of those psalms, but it's good to read them in context.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Thank Gail for refreshments this morning.
Yeah, thank you, Gail.
And see you in church and next week here.
Okay, thank you. See you next week. Go in peace. Thank you.